I'm Derek Kennedy. You're listening to special content produced by And Another Thing on New England Public Media.
Senator Gomez, thank you for joining And Another Thing. The last time we spoke, you had just won the Democratic primary and you defeated the five-term state senator incumbent James Welsh. How does it feel to be in Beacon Hill and representing Western Mass now?
It feels amazing. One, obviously, being the first person of color in my district to have held a seat. Obviously, you know, I come from humble beginnings, come from an advocacy background. And, you know, when you're on the ground, you're really working on changing people's lives. So being able to be put in a position to legislate on behalf of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, not only my district, but for all communities, is definitely a blessing. It's encouraging, it's motivating, and I'm determined to do the best job that I can. You know, it still has a wow factor to it, you know, being called senator.
You were also elected right in the middle of this pandemic. What is it like stepping into this role in the middle of that big of a crisis?
Well, it does have its challenges. You know, prior to myself being elected to the state Senate, you know, I've ran numerous campaigns for myself and others. So this one was kind of different. It was really unorthodox. We had to figure out how we were going to get to the community and to the people when you couldn't congregate. You know, it was hard to be out and, you know, to be able to canvass the right way. You know, more it was just a lot of lit drops. But, you know, once I was sworn in, it turned into kind of a very interesting approach because I had to be strategic on who I hired. Folks that been in the building a little bit and had some really good things to offer. So I hired an amazing staff. I have the most diverse staff, I think, in the building at the moment. I have my chief of staff is Asian American woman. My legislative director is Italian Irish woman. And then I have my district director, he's Black. And then my district aide, he's half Afghan and half Mexican, and myself being Puerto Rican. I just wanted to make sure that I have representation from everywhere. It just happened to be that way. I guess, you know, I didn't hire out of character. I hired for people that really apply for the job, and I thought that we're going to do an amazing job. And the last 6 months, they have been extraordinary. They've been doing great. COVID, I think it was a blessing and a curse, right? You suffer from not being in the building as much relationship-wise when you're trying to, you know, build fellowship with your brother and sister senators. But at the same time, it gives me a chance to learn it well, at least through virtual and at least having more leisure time because I'm not traveling as much back and forth. But then at the same time, leadership has been amazing. I have an amazing mentor, Senator Boncori, and I've just been really, a lot of senators have been welcoming and giving me a lot of advice. There is some difference to it because it's a bigger body, but being on the council for 5 years, walking into it kind of give me a really good perspective onto the ground. So in these spaces and in these committees and things, when we're talking about different things, I really have a really good, something to offer, I guess, a little bit more than a few. Not saying that they're not all, you know, well-rounded folks, but coming from the bottom, you know, up to, I guess, what people would call like Mount Olympus, I would say, right? You know, I bring that perspective, you know, to the state Senate, that which I think that makes me extraordinary.
Where you come from in Western Mass has one of the fastest growing rates of Hispanics in all of the state. And you being the first Afro-Latino to serve in the Massachusetts Senate, joining, of course, current senator and gubernatorial candidate, Senator Chang Diaz, what types of policies are you most focused on to reduce inequalities, not only for the Latinx community, Western Mass, but all of the Commonwealth?
Well, we know that regional equity when it comes to Western Mass is one of the biggest issues that we have. In Western Mass alone, we have, what, six senators? There's six senators in Boston alone. And, you know, when it comes to resources, health, housing, economic development. I want to make sure that, you know, when we're building equity in all of those systems, there's also building wealth within these communities as well. And sometimes, you know, we get the ish end of the stick, to be totally frank. You know, one thing we want to see is people being able to feed their families and get ahead, well-paying jobs, you know, and getting their fair share when it comes to health and access. Everybody wants to make sure that they have a well-paying job, world-class school, you know, and a place where you can breathe, you know, the environment is, you know, up to par. So, you know, when you have communities like myself, where I grew up in the poorest district in the state of Massachusetts, the north end of Springfield, we just want to be seen. We just want to be heard. We want to have access to those resources like everyone else. So that's one thing and what reason and motivated me to run for state senator. And obviously to be able to break some of those grass ceilings because, yeah, I'm probably one of the first, but I'm determined to make sure that I'm not the last.
What do you think it says that right now it's just you and Senator Chang Diaz representing the Latinx community?
It's humbling to be able to represent the Latinx community, but I'm just a senator that just happens to be Latinx. I'm Afro-Latino. I grew up hip-hop. I grew up Black in America, you know, and the most important thing Latinx folks need to understand is that, you know, our oppressors just spoke a different language. I think that the truth and the fact of the matter is our histories are definitely intertwined. But I think, you know, growing up in America with the different issues that are before us, you know, we have to be on the same side of equity and inclusion. And one of those reasons is for me to embrace that I'm Black and I speak Spanish. And you know what? I have a Euro side to me, too, that, you know, that is what do they call it on Ancestry, Iberian, right? But, you know, the truth is just to be able to own your truth. So that's something that's why I continuously, you know, beat my chest and tell people, you know what? Yeah, I'm Latino. I'm Latinx. But I'm also a Black man as well, because, you know, once we put that into perspective, we can actually move on and really talk about unity. That's that word, unity and community. It's there. We can't build community if we're not unified and stepping foot. There's nothing wrong with being pro-Black. There's nothing wrong with being pro-Latino. We have to make sure that we're there for our communities. But then when we come together, we become that collective majority. We just want to be able to thrive in with fairness with everyone else.
You're currently working on helping Massachusetts reopening. How are you making sure that that's happening in an equitable way?
So one, we're listening to staff. We're listening to constituents. I know that certain municipalities are wide open, but honestly, dealing with the House being selected, which I'm very thankful on the working group to converse with all of the staff members and other senators to put in perspective the different dynamics that are put forth. Let it be travel, let it be, you know, because people are coming out of, you know, working from home. So now it's, you know, I got to find childcare, or maybe I need to find elder care because they're caring for an elderly, or some people health-wise aren't prepared to be able to be around people as of yet because of the different variants that are out there. So that's kind of the things that I'm working towards. But just today, we had a great conversation with all staff members, and we're taking everybody's opinion very seriously on making sure that we're working obviously with leadership and with the governor and also with the House to make sure that we're moving forward with the best recommendations we can to create protocols that's gonna keep everyone in the House safe and also moving forward in the state of Massachusetts. I think that you know, we owe it to our constituents and our advocates that wanna come to the House, that when they come to the House, they're gonna come to a clean House and a safe House.
You just mentioned child care, elder care. One of your fellow Western Mass politicians, Ben Downing, was one of the first major candidates to throw his name in the hat for the next governor of Massachusetts. He recently launched the Downing Child Care Plan. In terms of universal help, whether it's elderly care, pre-K, universal child care, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm a big proponent to universal health care. I've been working on that on a federal level, on an advocacy standpoint with Senator Warren. And that's where kind of we've already kind of seen that kind of work happen. And also with SEIU 509, which we were working on an advocacy standpoint with the union on what universal child care would look like. But for the most part, I haven't looked at his proposal, which maybe could be the same. Him and I are kind of the same temperature. Great guy. I know that, you know, regardless of the outcome, Ben Downey does have his heart in the right place. And universal child care, like myself, I have a 4-year-old daughter. And before I was a state senator, child care was definitely hell. And before that, you know, I have a 12-year-old son and a 15-year-old daughter. So I know very well those times when we had to figure out if we're going to pay child care or buy dinner, or figure out how we're going to balance that. I live with a real perspective on life when it comes to housing, being elected to the Springfield City Council, being homeless, understanding food insecurity, and then figuring out how, you know, we want to get to work, but figuring out child care was always a problem. So outside of that, universal child care is something that I'm in full support of, but we just have to figure out how we're going to make it happen.
So in addition to being a father and a state senator, you are also a small business owner. And I bring that up because you came out in support of the millionaires tax. When we covered this on And Another Thing, we spoke with a small business owner and someone from the Beacon Hill Institute, both of whom said that the millionaires tax would be very bad for small business, that it would not generate as much revenue as advocates are saying it would. What's your response to this?
We're trying to build for the future. And we understand when you live the American dream isn't the same as it was 100 years ago. And at the moment, you know, the systems that were in place maybe worked 100 years ago, but we have to figure out how we're going to be able to sustain the things that we have responsibility over. There's mandated issues when it comes to education. Every child needs to be educated. When it comes to housing, everybody has a human right to have a house and to have food on the table. I was one of the ones that advocated, and I canvassed, and I must have submitted almost 10,000 signatures for the Fair Share Amendment. And in capitalism, for certain systems to work, certain taxations need to exist so then we can be able to support infrastructure, so we can be able to support, you know, roads, streets, and education and higher learning. But that just doesn't come out of thin air. And if we can help somebody climb out of poverty, because the passport out of poverty is education, and with a degree, why wouldn't I want to put $40,000 out of my $1 million that I made to making sure that I'm not incarcerating somebody with that $40,000, but putting somebody into school and educating them so then they can thrive and be there and be a upstanding citizen.
How important is infrastructure for you as you see how it's working in Eastern Massachusetts, but Western Mass has been left behind in this conversation? How involved are you, or how focused are you on helping to bridge the gap?
So the truth is, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to be in this position. We don't have a train, right? We don't have east to west yet, right? We don't connect. You know, if we want to get to Boston, if I wanted to take the train instead of drive, and I'm just using in my opinion, I have to take the train to Hartford, which is going to another state. Then from Hartford, I need to take it to Boston. Granted, it's only $16, but it adds another 45 minutes to my commute. We're losing population here, and they're gaining population out east. So how do we keep people here and wanting to invest and stay and make Western Mass home when there's not infrastructure that can get you from point A to point B fairly easy? We are going to be opening up the flyer again that comes north to south. And we've built a lot of infrastructure in different towns like Pittsfield, Greenfield, Holyoke, all the way down to Springfield to here, the renovated Union Station that's in my district. We want to connect that as well. But east to west is paramount. We have the biggest train company in the world that's stationed here in Western Massachusetts. If we're going to be building these trains for other infrastructures in other cities, why can't Springfield connect? It's just going to bring dollars to the economy and folks can get to work. Because here in the Western Mass, you know, I have one of the biggest immigrant communities that live in my district, but then they work north of my district, which is right there in the farms of in Hadley and stuff. And we want to make sure that people can move around safely. But if we had those trains and we had the access to infrastructure, maybe that's a way of getting folks to get to A to B, let it be healthcare facilities or get into school. We need access. Western Massachusetts has been left behind for quite a long time.
You mentioned the Work and Family Mobility Act, which you've come out in support of. One of the things that this act would do is allow everyone who's a resident of Massachusetts, regardless of their immigration status, to get a driver's license.
Absolutely.
What would this do for immigrants of all stripes who are living in Western Massachusetts?
One, there'd be a downturn of folks driving without a license on the roads, unregistered, uninsured. Secondly, we would keep families together. I think that a lot of people are racially profiled, like myself. I've been stopped a couple times because they assumed that I didn't have a license or registration. Maybe dad or mom is undocumented, but or they live in a mixed house that their kids are citizens. So, you know, for the most part, we want to make sure that our roads are safe. And this is a way that, one, we can help people get to work safely. Because if we don't have a train, just like, you know, public transportation out east, you know, folks are going to get into a car. We have third shift jobs that people don't want to take, that folks are ready and available to be able to work. The immigrant community, they are hardworking people, and they're going to do by any means necessary to get there to provide for their family. So let's make it easier, because in Massachusetts, we're mandated to educate them and we're mandated to give them health care. So let's mandate to make sure that they can get to those institutions to make sure that they're thriving and that their family is safe.
If you had a magic wand, what would be your first big problem in your district that you would want to solve?
How to get everybody back to work. Not only to work, but, you know, making enough money to be able to sustain and to put food on the table, you know, and be able to thrive and pay the rent. I think people just want to live and not worry. There's like a double-edged sword, right? Folks want to get back to work, but essentially it pays or it's beneficial to be able to hold on a little bit longer to a benefit. And a lot of people don't want to have this conversation. I might get some, you know, negative feedback on it, but, you know, there's a lot of struggling businesses that are hiring. There's a lot of struggling folks that, you know, want to work. And I think we have to keep in mind that, you know, COVID is not over. COVID is here. Everybody's talking about the Delta variant, but right now it's the Lambda variant. It just got released, and folks need to take this serious. If you want to get vaccinated, please get vaccinated. If the vaccine is available and you've been looking for an appointment, some of these folks are taking walk-ins right now. We owe it to our elders, and we owe it to the people that have comorbidities that live around us. You know, if we're not getting vaccinated, we're not going to get through this together. And that's just point one. And that I want to state in closing is, you know, whatever your belief system is, but if you have a chance and you have not been vaccinated, please take the time to be vaccinated.
If I can touch on that, for those that are not vaccinated, is that to say that they're not taking it seriously?
I come from a community that is skeptic about anything. I just think that the science overwhelmingly has shown that, you know, it's always has prevailed. It's like different diseases that you didn't think that we can overcome. Science has been able to overcome some of these challenges. Granted, I used to be one that used to be a skeptic. Like, I didn't want to get a shot in my arm for anything. But me being diabetic, hypertension, you know, I had to look at that and say, do I want to live or do I want to die? And something that's highly contagious like that, people put a responsibility in me to be able to serve my people. And if I'm, you know, fighting for these vaccines and I'm not going to get it, then what does that say as me as a leader, especially a person of color? Knowingly, in my community, they have been devastated of COVID-19, you know, and that was one of the reasons why I fought. Why, while, you know, we're opening these massive vaccine sites, which I thought that the vaccine should have been available early on within the neighborhoods. We want our people to flourish and to be able to look back at this time and say, we did this together and we moved on and we were able to accomplish, you know, something that people thought we couldn't. And then the naysayers will understand, well, you know what? Maybe I should have gotten that.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned previously about people choosing to perhaps stay on benefits rather than get back to work. Could it not be said that perhaps those business owners need to offer more wages, offer better benefits for people to get back to work?
Yes. And that was one of the conversations. That's funny that you brought that up, because I was one of the advocated again for $15 an hour. And now we've seen that even $15 an hour is not enough. And we need to figure out how, and obviously that comes with, you know, wages being stagnated for over 30, 40 years versus, you know, we've seen corporations during COVID make millions and billions and the rich have become richer. So, you know, we're in a position that we have to make sure that certain types of business, it's equitable for them to be able to pay that much. Because right now, let's be honest, before I was a senator, I couldn't afford to live in Boston, right? Never, probably not even in Worcester. Would I pay for rent now? For people, I tell them, oh my God, it's a lot of money. I'm paying $1,300 for a 3-bedroom here in Western Massachusetts. And people are like, what? I'm paying that for like a studio, you know, or something of that magnitude. So it's like wages, we need to really take a look at that. You know, we've been trying to get people to $15 an hour over, I think, up until 2021. But by the time that kind of trajectory happens, we're in a position now that we're looking at, we need $20 an hour, $25 an hour to we'll be able to raise a child. Those are things that we really need to look at. People that work 40 hours a week, they need help too. You know, it's not that people are just sitting around doing nothing.
You mentioned this, so I'm going to follow up on it. The Delta variant is real. If by chance our country or our states start to try and pull back restrictions now to get this thing under control, how would you help Western Mass, particularly because they were hit so hard, make sure that they're educated and protecting themselves and their families?
If we go back into a restricted situation, you know, I think we have to be really honest with ourselves. Right now, folks were locked down over a year. And when the sun comes out and, you know, numbers are down, sometimes I think, you know, folks think that it's over. I think that's what it is. And that now this is like traveling season. So folks are visiting family that they haven't seen over a year, visiting different locations, and it's spreading just how it spread before when it came out of Wuhan, right? Through travel. And I think we're in a position now that maybe, you know, like any other virus, that, you know, it mutates and it continues mutating. Mostly all of the, I think 50% of all the positive cases have been the Delta virus. And now I just seen a report that there's a new variant called the Lambda. And I said, as a legislature, he's like, when is this going to be over? How is this going to be over? And how do I, to a certain position, I can use my social media. I can fight for these resources. I can spread the right information. I can go out, get the shot, record myself getting the shot, hold somebody's hand, take them to go get the shot. But I'm only one person. We need more boots on the ground that are spreading this positive message of life and wanting to get through to of coming back and making sure that kids are going back to school, making sure it's safe to go back to school, making sure that people can go back to work. But when you have folks that believe that this is a hoax or nothing's going to happen because more people kind of get through the virus versus the mortality rate. Right. I think that, you know, we're really into a really hard decision. And that's why opening up the state house has become a job in its own. Because even though other municipalities are fully open, you know, their city halls and other state houses, you know, Massachusetts and the Senate and the House want to get it right the first time. I don't think that there's a dollar that's worth a person's life. So even though we need to make sure that the economy moves and we're in a positive incline of trying to get right back to it and make a society move, we have to have a real conversation of life or death. But I'm very optimistic, and I'm very for sure that we are going to get through this, but we got to do it together. We can't, it can't be just one group or the other group, and, you know, we'll get through it and we'll check on each other later. This has to be a movement of people wanting to get better and do better. And this is going to be, I think, you know, masks maybe not, will not go away where we're at with COVID, that masks might stay around for quite a while until people are very comfortable with, you know, these different kind of pathogens that are out there in the world.
I want to pivot to asking a little bit about your background. You were arrested when you were young, as happens to many Black and brown men. How has that informed the kind of legislator you want to be?
So when I was 17, just for the listeners, I was charged with the mandatory minimum. I ended up pleading out to possession with intent. And they dropped my school zone, even though I was arrested in school, with 10 bags of marijuana. And if I didn't, I was going to spend 2 years in jail, my first criminal offense. I was charged as an adult when I was 17. Obviously, now that age is different. That's what kind of preempted me to just get involved with the advocacy work with the criminal justice reform that was passed in 2017. I was working on that with the Jobs Not Jails Coalition with one of my best friends, Jafet Robles, that's no longer with us. That piece of legislation was the one that actually changed my perception and opinion and getting involved with community, because I always had something hanging over my head, you know, when it came to looking for a job and trying to figure out, you know, how I was going to feed the family. And that kind of like little record always chased me. And then obviously now, you know, with the law being changed and the prohibition on marijuana is over here in Massachusetts, obviously not federally, it really drove me to really use my skills and my personal test, you know, my personal story, so that, you know, you can turn your life around and you can be whatever you want to be. Some people have changed their and became a lawyer and, you know, been incarcerated and helped people get out of jail. And now they're running for mayor of New York, you know, like just because you've gotten in trouble once or twice or three times, you know, I tell people you can fall on your face 8 times, but as long as you get up 9 and you keep on pushing, I think that's the most important part to this. And I think that, you know, I give it to the legislators that came before me that gave me an opportunity to be able to advocate on behalf of those bills that helped me grow as a man, but grow as a community advocate and grow as a city councilor and help me become a Massachusetts state senator. I think that, you know, with these reforms, I think in some divine way, it was funny, I shared this meme, right, that said, I don't know what I'm doing, but I gave it all to God. And for some reason, I give him all my success. And, you know, it's not to put God into it. It's just sometimes, like I said, it that wow factor. I don't know how it happened, but it did. But when good people run and good people believe, good people get elected. You know, I'm not the sharpest tool in the tool shed, but at the same time, I got a heart of gold that when I say I'm going to do something, we're going to make it happen. Or if not, we're gonna keep on fighting until, you know, somebody else can pick up the torch. Got to keep on mobilizing, you know, the people to continue, you know, doing our duty, and that's to make sure that every single vote counts. So, you know, being arrested, I'm not gonna lie to you, it was I told the judge he was never gonna see me again, and he didn't. And I honestly, you know, it helped me motivate a lot of young people and a lot of people my age to start businesses, to change their lives as well. And, you know, I'm still a work in progress. But at the moment, I'm a real person that suffered through homelessness, suffered through a criminal background, tried to figure out how I'm going to, you know, feed my family on whatever job it is that I could get, working 2 to 3 jobs. You know, like, I know what that feels like. And even looking at single moms, you know, like, it's not easy. Kids growing up in a broken home. And there's a lot of people that have extraordinary stories. My story is just one of them. And I just hope to inspire people to be able to motivate and be better than they were today, you know, because tomorrow's a new day.
Everyone that knows your name, Western Mass or beyond, they also know your dad. Please tell me how your dad feels about calling his son a state senator. How proud of you is he?
Man, I tell you this, man. That man, as much as I bumped heads with him growing up, he had the right idea. He instilled in me to fight for our people. When he first got here to Springfield, he fought for veterans. And then he fought for ward representation because he knew that the dynamic of the council didn't look like what the city represented. And after suing the city and filing the home rule petition with, at the time, Charlie Ryan and former state representative, but he was president of the council, Jose Tassado, and being able to bring ward representation here, that was one of the reasons why today the Springfield City Council is minority majority. And I was able to serve 5 years, three terms on the Springfield City Council. He was never elected, but this year I was able to, he was able to be appointed into my position. So I was able to give him his flowers, to swear my father in. And right now he's still a tremendous veterans advocate, nationally renowned. You know, he got a phone call from Kamala Harris the other day, vice president. It was absolutely amazing, like all this extraordinary things that I'm being able to build with him now. And when the times that you didn't want to listen to your folks, and then now that day that that we found out we won, first time I told my dad, man, like, bro, like, I said, I hope I make you proud. And man, you choked me up with that one. I appreciate the question. My dad is my hero. Gumercindo Gomez, that is my hero. That is Captain Puerto Rico.
Because you are from Springfield, the police department has been federally labeled as one of the worst in the entire country. There's problems within that department, and being an Afro-Latino, a brown guy, how can you help?
I've been a victim of, you know, my run-ins, obviously, with the police. And, you know, I had like a stigma that followed me. So obviously we could talk about that. That's another story on how, and then becoming a city councilor, and then the tables had turned, and all of a sudden, you know, people start treating you with a little bit more respect. But, you know, the truth is my mom was a police commissioner, right? So before there was a police commissioner, there was a police commission. And in Springfield, it was a civilian police commission. And when the fiscal oversight board came, when we were going through some fiscal challenges in the city of Springfield before my time, they eliminated all the commissions and they created commissioners. So fire commissioner, police commissioner, and they thought it would have been more of a way of being able to work through the different issues. And it was, to them, it was the best way to do things. But we knew that there was a lot of police misconduct issues that were happening in Springfield. And there was a lot of nepotism, a lot of different extraordinary things that obviously that has hit the media. There's some things that haven't hit the media. And the Springfield City Council has been fighting for a police commission since, I think, before I was on it, but I was on at least two different times where we tried to vote and override a veto. And then this year we just had to sue the mayor, and it was adjudicated that he has to implement the police commission as soon as possible. But then he appealed it, so now it's in appeals court. But to be frank, you know, part of that that DOJ report was off of the impact unit were abusing their authority. And then we have a couple other instances. We were paying out extraordinary amounts of money for police misconduct while I was on the council every single year, up into the millions. And, you know, I'm going to be honest, we're going to see probably more of that. I think our brighter days are ahead of us. We still have a lot of challenges. I know that police reform that was just passed last year, there's a lot of narrative going around the defund the police conversation, which I would like to switch it up and say, it's not about that we don't think that we need public safety, right? But we need to put in perspective of not about defunding the police, but how we're going to refund our communities. So that's the way I want to tell the story is, you know, maybe we have to reallocate funds, and that's onto the councils, because I'm on a, obviously I'm onto the Senate, is how do we continuously refund our communities, making sure that public safety is still steadfast and making sure that police accountability and also resources are available to train some of these police officers. You know, my heart goes out to the last couple of weeks, we've lost a lot of police officers in the line of duty. And I have a lot of family that is in law enforcement, you know, but at the same time, they understand the position that I take. They know that it's not that I don't support the police, but I support accountability first and making sure that our communities are safer by that. So Springfield has, we have a long road ahead of us. We've been making some good inroads.
I know you just got into the state Senate, but do you see a future where you could see yourself running on a federal level, perhaps for a representative position?
If the opportunity presented itself in my community was 110% behind me, of course. I believe in the leadership that we have now. He has been a friend to my community for a very long time, Congressman Richard Neal. And obviously, with any doubt in my mind, I think that, you know, under his leadership, Springfield has thrived. And, you know, obviously, there's always work and better work that we need to get done. But I think that we're at a position that being the strongest Democrat in the House, being the chairman of Ways and Means, it brings a lot of resources to Massachusetts. And him being the dean of the New England caucus, well, the New England caucus of Dems, I think we're in good hands. But if he had retired or something like that, it doesn't have to be me. It could be anybody. But people need to realize, I'd be remiss to say that if you think that communities of color are gonna waste another 30 years and not jump into a race like that, I'm not saying it's me, but anybody. I just want to encourage anybody to be able to be that face of change. And, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. And we have to just be we have to work together, because at the end of the day, we need each other.
I feel like that's kind of the same sentiment for the race of governor right now. So many people are throwing their hat into being the next one, right? And we still don't know, by the way, if the incumbent Governor Charlie Baker will run, but what do you think the next governor of Massachusetts needs to bring in order to elevate Massachusetts in terms of being future leaders and making change?
That's a great question. Economically, Governor Baker doesn't get the kudos, you know, in certain instances to be able to, you know, be able to lead during COVID. I know that a lot of people have a difference of opinion, but true blue Democrat, obviously, which I am, I think that we have a chance to break glass ceilings. Obviously, Governor Baker is highly favored still. He hasn't made a strong decision if he's going to run. But in respect to moving forward, I think that this state could be moved by a woman of color. I know we have two women of color that are in the race. One of them is my colleague. Another one, I believe, is the Harvard professor, Danielle Allen. And then, you know, obviously the elephant in the room that everybody keeps on mentioning could be A.G. Maura Healey. And then you have Ben Downey in, at the moment, Karen Pulido. And you know, so I'm not going to say it's early, but whatever they got to bring to the table has to be some tenacity, some truth. They got to bring their self. And honestly, I don't think we're at a position now that you can't fool the constituent anymore. You can't just come in and, you know, read off the script and be the politician that you usually see. I think that people want a human being. They want somebody that has candor, that has bite, that's fighting for different things. And I think that we have an array of candidates that can do that.
Senator Adam Gomez, thank you so much for joining us on And Another Thing. It's been an absolute pleasure.
And thank you. It's important for you to have these conversations because, you know, we're human. Elected officials are human. We go through things just like everybody else. And I think it's wrong for people to keep on moving, thinking that we're superhuman. We're extraordinary. Trust me, because it takes a village to be able to move policy in it. But I think that, you know, this radio station, what you guys are doing and showing the human thing of people and making sure that, you know, people are given a little bit of them and my story, hopefully it immobilizes and inspires somebody to be the next Massachusetts state senator.
I'm Maya Schwader. Join the conversation. Email us at andanotherthing@nepm.org or reach us across social platforms at Hello and Another.